Cocaine Gang! How you doing? Don't say anything. That's not the way this audio file thing works. It's just output. There's no input other than the input that I happen to be outputting. I've been very, very busy, both personally and professionally, but it's good to be able to say something again and to be able to have 3 seconds so that I can give you an update as to what's going on, as well as to give you a bit of new and what I think is rather compelling content. Recently, Ponzi and I were planning on moving to Los Angeles, but those plans kind of fell through, and I'm not really at liberty to discuss why. But needless to say, everyone says things always happen for a reason. So we're going with that, and we're moving forward, marching forward. In fact, we're moving still, not to Los Angeles, but actually staying in the Seattle area. We're moving next week, and boy, oh boy, that's going to be a tremendous challenge. But even in doing so, I'm hoping to learn a thing or two about homeownership and being able to talk to people who know a thing or two about, I guess, home projects that everybody has to deal with, not just technology-related, but everything related to the home. So, again, we're staying in the Seattle area, and then not long after that, on December 9th, 2006, Ponzi and I are getting married in downtown Bellevue, and invited as many people as we possibly can at this point. And, of course, you might remember months ago I had asked Robert Scoble to be my best man, and he accepted immediately, and that conversation actually happened through IM, of all things. He was still working at Microsoft at the time. But I've known Robert for years and years and years, and Ponzi has asked Miriam Scoble to be her matron of honor, and she has accepted as well. So it's going to be a fun time. Moving, wedding, oh boy, two of the most stressful things that could possibly happen in a person's life, and they're happening within the next couple of weeks. And then on the professional side of things, LockerGnome.com has been retooled, if you hadn't already noticed. We've got possible dates for GnomeDeck 7, maybe. We're thinking August 9th through the 11th, 2007. I think that's the right weekend. But again, those are tentative dates, so if you do anything on your calendar, just make sure it gets penciled in, unless you're using Google Calendar, in which case it's not pencil compatible. That was a very bad joke, and I apologize for that. I've also been busy working on Undo TV, and that's an effort that has been spearheaded largely by Leo Laporte and myself as a, I guess, a community funnel for former Tech TV talent who are still quite talented and the Tech TV community. Essentially, it's a place where we can bring all our content together in one spot and melt the best of the community with the best of the content producers. So you have a chance to throw your hat into the ring or your content into the ring and own, retain 100% ownership of the content that you put there. So again, it's a funnel. That's the easiest word I could use to describe exactly what it is. In doing that, we've been preparing to get the Chris Perillo Show ready for that transition, because the Chris Perillo Show will still continue to exist. We'll continue to do interviews and other wacky things, but I plan on doing high-definition video very soon. That's going to start not long after I get my home office set up. Although we have been offered some studio space in town to do some recording, I don't know how that's going to work out yet. A couple of weeks ago, the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences, that's essentially the people who do the Grammys, they held a Music Tech Summit up here in Seattle. And it was originally scheduled to happen at EMP, and what had happened was that in the morning, during Thomas Dolby's keynote, and Thomas Dolby, the guy, you know, She Blinded Me with Science, that guy, was awesome. He, man, you want to talk about a geek. Man, he is it. He's a geek. Right in the middle of his presentation, the fire alarms went off. Apparently, Clear Channel had broken a gas line just outside, so we had to evacuate the entire building. Well, the organizers of the event had basically done some calling around, and we were really close to the Seattle Center, and so we ended up settling in McCall Hall. And it heard the rest of Thomas Dolby's presentation and then the panel that I was on, which was largely geared towards vendors, it seemed. I was the only non-vendor who was on the panel and as just a regular guy, but we were all talking about marketing, you know, one's music using the internet and other digital means. So it was interesting. I definitely had the audience more than the vendors did, I think. And a few people had said that, you know, they really appreciate when vendors don't have, you know, the total control in a situation like that where you have a presentation or specifically a panel. So I want to give that to you, but you know, if you're in the holiday spirit and you're doing shopping, you might want to register a domain name. And if you do, go to GoDaddy.com and use the coupon code Chris1. That's one word, Chris1, but it's actually a number one. So CHRIS1, number one, you know, on your keyboard, the number one. And you'll save some money. And that's kind of just a gift that we want to give to you as a listener. You know, if you're wanting to buy a domain, which I still say is a great holiday gift. I mean, even if it's a gag domain, I mean, they're relatively cheap to get anymore, your own .com. So you might as well do it and save even more money by using the coupon code Chris1. So here's the panel. I want to apologize beforehand for the quality. It was recorded on Derek K. Miller's iPod, and we're lucky he recorded it because I don't think anybody else had done it, because we had been moved and all the equipment was still back at the EMP. So this is Derek K. Miller's recording, and of course you know Derek, you remember Derek from penmachine.com. Yeah, well, I appreciate him even recording it, and we're putting it up so you can all listen to it. So you may have to fiddle with your volume. We tried to normalize it to a point where you could make out what everybody's saying, but it's really good content, and hopefully you'll agree with me. And if you don't, well, you know, there's always the skip button. Sit back and enjoy.
Does anybody need a break out there? Just a quick bio break to run out of you. You okay? Just like going straight into it.
All right. Straight in.
We're just going to go straight in. Come on up, panelists. You know who you are. So while they're coming down, I'll just give you a brief intro to myself. I spent 11 years in London as an artist, musician, producer, engineer. In fact, Thomas and I shared a management company way back in the day. And I've spent the last 10 years in technology here, and I remember the first thing that really got me excited about technology was being able to listen to John Peel on my desktop in Pioneer Square, and just went, this is so cool. I mean, we have all this cool technology that's been building and building and building. And the question is now, with the signal-to-noise ratio being what it is, and now basically it's really easy to record your stuff, and so consequently there's a lot of stuff out there. So what we're going to try and disseminate in the next hour or so is, how do you get yourself noticed? How do you raise your signal high enough so that you can see it? Or is that even important? You know, we're not necessarily in a hit-driven environment anymore where you have to have that hit that sells hundreds of thousands of copies to justify your existence to a company. You could conceivably just be making that music for yourself or for a small group of people or for enough people that just keeps you happy enough to make that music. So we have an esteemed panel here. We have Christina Calio from Microsoft. We've got Jessica Stoner from Pandora. We've got Chris Perillo here from Locronome. And we have Dan D'Angelo Valenti from Melodia. And I'm not going to bore you with their bios because they're in the thing. We need to make up some time here. So the first question I want to ask is for you each to give just a quick introduction of how people can, you know, get their music noticed using your various services. Let's start with you, Christina. We're going to have to just pass the mic down. So.
Hi. Hopefully people are starting to hear about it, but at Microsoft we do have a new music initiative called Zune, and that includes a device, which I've got a couple of them here if people want to come take a look, and a marketplace. So we'll be selling downloads and subscription service, and then eventually video shortly thereafter, very similar to what iTunes is doing today. And I think the very exciting part of the conversation is what will be happening in the future, and a little bit more about the vision for where we're going to go, which is really about hopefully making it a lot better for artists to connect with their fans and to build on what the current experience is. For now, a lot of the ways that you can get promoted through Zoom is in our marketplace and using the device to share wirelessly your songs with your friends.
How many people here are familiar with Pandora already?
I love to see that. Thank you. So then you know that we are radio and that we're part of the technology shift that Thomas was talking about earlier. As we come to a connected world, radio can be programming for each and every listener, catering to their tastes, as opposed to broadcasting format, meaning trying to find the lowest common denominator of a playlist that appeals to a lot of people listening kind of. So what this means for artists like yourselves is that when somebody comes in looking for Thomas Dolby's music, if your music is like his, it has the opportunity to be playing for the audience, your potential audience out there, who have a high propensity to be a fan of your music.
it can be presented at just the right time. And that's what Pandora is really doing with our radio program. Behind the scenes of that radio experience that you see online is something called the Music Genome Project, which has been a labor of love for the past 7 years. And it started with a bunch of musicians and folks who had, you know, left college and got into a band and started touring and had a lot of the same experiences about how hard it is when you're a needle in a haystack to have to rise above and meet, to greet a large audience with your music. And they said, well, if we could help people by using what they know and love already as a departure point, and then introduce them to other music that has a musicological similarity, that sounds like this music, then perhaps we could help to make those connections. So the Music Genome Project, we have 45 musicians on site with headphones on, listening to songs one at a time. And they're describing actually what's happening in the music itself. They're describing the melody and the harmony and the instrumentation and the lyrics and the vocal performance. Some on an order of magnitude, 400 different, what we call genes, that when taken in combination, describe that piece of music, that song's unique signature. Like the Human Genome Project, we all look a lot alike, but at a genomic level, but we're all very unique. And songs are similar. So as an artist, you should send your music to Pandora. We will listen to everything that is sent to us. The only editorial decision that we make in the process of creating our database is what we will put into our collection that would have the opportunity to come up in playlists. But we definitely, as a company of musicians, err on the side of inclusion rather than exclusivity. So part of your, when you finish a record, part of your checkoff list ought to be, send my album to Pandora.
I think I'm an ugly duckling, because I'm not a vendor, I'm just a geek. I listen to music. Is that okay? I'm a technologist, blogger. I guess I could be labeled. If you go to Google and you type in my first name, Chris, I'm the first one to pop up. I've been doing it for years, at being a technologist, but also a marketer to a certain degree. I've had one of my videos, and I haven't uploaded many, but hit the front page of YouTube a few weeks ago, and it was just me mimicking the overhead announcements in an airplane, and I was, well, I did it, and I didn't get the camera taken away, luckily enough, but that ended up, that bit of creative spark ended up, I guess, ringing true with YouTube's editors. That's kind of what I do, just random little things that I think are fun and interesting. So I see technology as a vehicle or a gateway, almost in a pervasive sense, not necessarily as here's a gadget, here's a gizmo, that's great, there's a million and one of those, there's a million and one types of laptops and brands, but what is it doing to enhance your lifestyle, your life? And certainly music plays a big part of it. My ranges of musical tastes are quite eclectic, so Pandora doesn't know what to make of me, because I'm all over the map, which is great, and I live in music, but I think my perspective for being on this panel is just talking about how to get your stuff from point A to point B, whether you don't want to be involved with the business at all from the artist of the question that was asked earlier, or whether you're trying to figure out from a marketing perspective for a business or a company how to address an audience or how to do something on the internet. It's just kind of what I do. And then I've also got the conference we mentioned in the byline in Seattle. It's a technology-based conference, but we talk very much to any level of person that technology influences. So we've had people bring their girlfriends and or wives to the conference, and they enjoyed it just as much as the hardcore technologists. So I guess I'm just a regular guy. It's an honor to be here, I guess.
Well, that's tough to follow. I'll follow Jessica's example and ask the audience a question to start. How many people in the audience have a mobile phone? Good. How many people have an iPod or another MP3 player? I think more have mobile phones than have MP3 players or iPods. I co-founded Melodio 3 years ago to focus on bringing music and other media to mobile phones, which is several orders of magnitude larger market than iPod, even in its most successful year. I think maybe this year Apple will sell, take a guess, 40 or 50 million iPods. Unbelievably successful. I probably bought 5 or 6 and lost 3 or 4 of them. This year, the mobile phone industry will probably set the mark of selling a billion with a B, new handsets. And by the end of next year, they'll be selling 1.2, 1.3 billion handsets a year. I mean, there's no consumer electronics product on the planet that has ever come close to it, or will come close to the mobile phone as a platform. And now that, in many cases, in Europe and in Asia, that platform has broadband connectivity to the internet, it's the mobile computer in your pocket. And it's not just for sending text messages or making phone calls. It's now a platform to which you can distribute all kinds of media. Music, video, Thomas is making a killing doing ringtones to mobile phones. Frankly, I don't get that, but it's a big business. How many people in this audience have ever downloaded and paid for a ringtone? Chris? That's pretty good. Actually, Thomas has. That's an amazing phenomenon. We founded Melodio 3 years ago to take the concept of iTunes and iPod, a synchronized web and device solution, and push it out to mobile phones. And we launched the first service in Spain, actually, Telefonica, using their network to download music over the air, a la carte downloads. And they are charging €1.50 per track. Pretty darn expensive to download a track, but you also get a track delivered to your PC. And in the US, Sprint has launched a service that charges $2.50 a download. And I don't know if you get a copy delivered to the PC or not at that price. That's not a mass market opportunity at $2.50 a track. I don't know about you, but I might sample once or twice something I'm really desperate to get, and I'll pay $2.50. But it's not something that I'm going to do as a regular course. And as Thomas said, I think ultimately the market's going to settle out so that the cost to download to a mobile phone should be the same as what it costs to download music online. It's just another computer in your pocket with a different way of connecting up to the web. The fact that it's in everybody's pocket, it's always with you, gives you that opportunity to discover music in the moment in that bar. Gee, what is that tune? Identify that tune with things like Shazam and otherwise. And in the moment, to download that music to your mobile phone and at the same time have a copy of it delivered to your PC. Now, because the economics of doing that on mobile networks, carriers are very greedy. Are there any carriers in the audience here? I don't want to offend anybody, but...
Too late.
Carriers are very greedy. The music labels want a very high price for the music that we licensed from them so that we can serve it up. And there ain't a lot left for aggregators like Melodio in the middle. So we are now, 2 years after we launched the music service in Spain and in Canada and in China, we're unplugging that. And instead, we're doing MobileCast, which is streaming podcasts to mobile phones, including quite a lot of podcasts that are music. And I hate the word podcast. It really is a misnomer. It's really radio on demand. And so this is now giving consumers the opportunity to select from a very, very large catalog of audio and video, stream it to the mobile phone. In the case of music, we disable downloads so that we're being legit. But if you hear something you like, you can click to have it delivered to the PC. So just to sum up, the mobile phone is this platform that is in everybody's pocket. It has broadband connectivity to the internet. I think it's going to become an extraordinarily valuable platform for distribution of indie music. We're pretty excited to be, I think, at the cutting edge, if not the leading edge of that business.
Well, okay, now we know who we've got up here and how they're potentially going to be able to help you. The first thing I'd like to talk about is that Thomas brought up the whole idea that the artist now has a significant greater amount of control with their own careers now. And it should be immediately obvious to you that one of the first things you need is some sort of web presence, because through your website, you're going to be able to market, you're going to be able to talk and interact with your audience, you're going to be able to sell them things. It's absolutely critical that you have some sort of web presence, whether it's just a MySpace site or your own site. So what I'd like to do is start off with Chris and discuss, well, if he can get Chris to be the number one hit in Google, I'd like you to discuss some of the ways that you can promote your own site. And then what I'd like is each of the panelists to talk about how they can drive traffic back to your site. Because it's great that they get your music out there, but you also want that traffic to your site because you want to start to build a community around your artistic endeavor. So let's start with Chris.
That wasn't paid for, by the way. It's an organic placement. That's the term they use in search engine terms for a natural occurrence in a search engine listing. It's a loaded question, so to speak, because there's no one right answer. But certainly, having a web presence is the first thing. And MySpace, while very important, is not your space. It's their your space. So, Bill sat on a panel with me before, so he knows how raucous I can get when it comes to this stuff. All in good fun. But to own your own stuff is very, very important, but to have that presence on the web is also important. Being there is half the battle. Getting traffic is even more difficult, but part of it is doing things, not just putting a website online, because everybody can do it, anybody can do it, they can have a blog, they can have a podcast, they can do anything. But what are you going to do differently from everybody else? I'm going to use an example that's quite germane, specifically to this audience. I'm a big fan of Weird Al Yankovic. I used to have a fan page for him years and years ago. And a few weeks ago, right when he was recording his new album, which is out now, which is hilarious, he recorded a parody from James Blunt, the You're Beautiful, and it was You're Pitiful, is what he called it. And it's great. Well, apparently, Atlantic, the label, pardon, this is not my business, said no, even though James Blunt said, yes, it's okay. So what Al did was he put the MP3, like high-quality MP3, on his website, which of course got swamped immediately, because he wanted to get it out there, because he got the artist's permission, but he couldn't put it on the album because of Atlantic. So immediately I sent an email off to the drummer from Bermuda, and I said, okay, dude, this is what you need to do, because your website is not set up to handle this amount of downloads. So we need to set up mirrors and get people to copy the file. And eventually that's what happened. And so now the MP3, while not available on the album, is available on yankovic.com. Doing that, from his perspective, was really unique for the fans. And I'm also a They Might Be Giants fan, and they were doing Dial a Song years ago. Now they're getting into the podcast phase. I can count on it every week. I can listen to it. They're doing something different I'm not saying it's unique, but as a fan, they're keeping me in their mind share, other than, hey, I've got a new album out, or, hey, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. They're keeping me interested. And the more things you can think, it's so hard to say, but as long as you can stay in that mind share with not only your fans, but in the general populace. So, for instance, the Yankovic thing ended up getting picked up, the story got picked up on NPR, and, there was a story behind it. There's a whole bunch of stuff, that gets thrown in there. But I think it boils down to being able to connect to the fans, give the fans what they want, and then be able to be yourself, too, and promote what you want to promote. So whether it's, creating the single that hooks to the album, or it's the music, or stuff that you want to create that's going to hook people. But just having a website up there, don't put it in Flash. That's horrible. Bad. It's cool. But you gotta have text. If you wanna be indexed in search engines, you gotta have something people can latch onto. Email newsletter is good. Make sure you have an RSS feed. I know these are technical terms, but they're very important in terms of marketing and positioning of your own website. It's so hard to compress it down because I don't wanna spend too much time.
I think I can't amplify enough Chris's comment. You gotta be really tech savvy to get full control of your listing in this new digital world, because things like search engine optimization are not sort of concepts that naturally roll off the tongue of most people. So I'm sort of the analog guy in this digital world, so I'm figuring out a lot of this stuff as I go. Unfortunately, there's a lot of people that work in my company that are really good at this. But if you don't know how to honestly trick the search engines, it's really, really hard to get discovered in this vast ocean of digital content that's out there. So that's a really, really important component of enabling yourself to be discovered. In the mobile phone context, obviously you've got the extra barrier, the constraint of having a very constricted user interface, a tiny little screen and a tiny little keyboard, that makes it really important to have software on the phone that makes it easy to search through large databases of content from a device that's in the pocket. And you know, we think we've done some pioneering work there on enabling people to search very large databases in a very clever way on the mobile phone and to synchronize it with the databases on the web so that if you create something on the web, it's immediately reflected in the client on your mobile phone and vice versa, kind of a new thing for us. But the scary part of it is, yes, you can control your own destiny, but you really got to be very tech savvy to understand how to make it possible for people to discover who the hell you are. It's really, really, really tough.
Well, I wanted to start by saying, as radio, the first service that we are trying to help provide to musicians everywhere is to help you find your audience, connect with your audience at the opportune moment when they're looking for music like yours. Personally, as an artist, I put out an album of my own in 2002, and of course, being a deaf person, I made sure it was in my employment contract and my music got into they were kind enough to say it was worthy. So I got an email just the other day from the person who runs the music operations, and he had done a little data mining and said, hey, you know, these two of your songs are doing really well. They've spun over 100,000 times on Pandora. And I said, gosh, this is really valuable information for artists. We're building something here, which is another form of value that potentially we could down the road productize and give back to artists. So I'm not speaking officially on behalf of the company, but as a musician, I would really love to see us do that over time. But, you know, at first thing we need to do is build an audience. Fortunately, we've been doing that. We have now over 4 million registered listeners on Pandora. And they spent about 22.5 million hours listening last month. So it's growing and growing, and that means that the opportunities for making those meaningful connections with people who have all kinds of tastes, and one of the things I think that brings people to Pandora is the fact that we are catering to musical tastes in niches that broadcast formats couldn't, because they couldn't put together an audience in a particular geography large enough to justify building a format and driving advertising dollars around it. But we can do it because we're aggregating them no matter where they are in the U.S. And programming just for you. And unfortunately, as a business, we can have advertisers who, once we've aggregated enough of you, are interested in talking to those folks who are listening to email in the, between the ages of 18 and 34. And thank goodness for businesses and companies who want to talk to you, because that's why you can then come on this for free, and that's why we can help get people connected to music. So, you know, we have profile pages now on Pandora where users, and, you know, we now have a community of listeners, and we're doing things to help them to connect with each other, other folks with tastes similar to theirs. And I would love to see that community evolve to embrace also the artists and give back to them.
So I'm just thinking about it, and I think it's interesting to look back at how things have evolved for an artist. It seemed like for a long time, the way that you really were heard was to get on radio and to get some significant airplay and to be carried in retail. And then BDS and Sounds again came along, and things kind of shifted from, you know, you were more likely to get a hit if you had the record promoters out there with their little bags of Coke and cash, you know. So all of a sudden, people, the radio promo guys, were carrying laptops around and saying, but look at these figures in this, you know, area, and radio's up and sales are moving. And then it kind of moved into, well, you had to have a video in high rotation at MTV, and that was really the way that you were going to succeed. And then it was all about being on the homepage of AOL. And then, of course, now it's pretty much you're trying to get on iTunes. Can I get on the front page of iTunes? And I think most recently what's been interesting to me is, as I've talked to record companies, the first thing they want to tell me when they're trying to tell me about a new artist is how many friends the band has on MySpace. And that's really like their number one thing they want to tell you about to get you excited about the band. So things have definitely shifted. And at Zoom specifically, we've kind of looked at that and are on the same page with Xbox. And Xbox has really grown given Xbox Live. And I don't know if everyone's kind of had an Xbox or knows what the Xbox Live experience is, but it's really focused on community. Where it used to be, you know, a video game where you sat in a room by yourself playing a video game with a bag of chips or whatever, and now it's really about you go online and play with a community of people around the world. You can look and see when your favorite band is playing and try to play with them. and you could really have that connection which you didn't have before. And that's one of the key things that we're doing at Zoom, is every device has this ability to share wirelessly. So let's say you're a band and you have some songs that you haven't released yet. If there are other people around, or if you're running into other people with the Zoom, hopefully there will be more of those coming up, you can go ahead and theme a song wirelessly, and then that person has that song. So there's a way to kind of get your music out in a very person-to-person way. And I think over time, that's really where we're headed, is more the MySpace and Xbox Live kind of road of community and people being able to find each other on the internet and discover music that way.
Cool, thank you. Well, it's really all about developing a community, because that's traditionally what the record company was supposed to do, was just find an audience for you. Now basically that's your job, is to try and build your own audience. But through email and through lists and blogs, you now have the potential to do that, and you get to keep it. Before, this was information the record company kept hidden and wouldn't let you access. So it's very, very good times now for us artists who are trying to start from scratch. So assuming that an artist is doing their part of the job and they're building their community and they've got 10 billion friends on MySpace, how do they interface with your various services, and you know, what's the best way for them to approach you to get included? Are there things that they can do to make themselves noticed to you?
So I'll start and say, over time this hopefully is going to evolve. I think we're still in the middle of where we were and where we're going. Very practically today, we have a deal with MusicNet, so along with a lot of the other services that are in the marketplace, Napster and a lot of other people, if you have a deal with them for distribution through MusicNet, then your music is going to be available in the marketplace. We also have blogging communities that are out there. I mean, if you search for Zoom in the meantime, you get like some ridiculous number of responses. And then we're also trying to really commit ourselves to some artist development work at the moment. And so we're looking for unsigned artists or artists that are maybe on an indie label, and we're working with them, and we're trying to, it's not a lot to start, you know, maybe 4 or 6 hour artists a quarter, but that we can support throughout a quarter, whether that's working with them on tours or doing a video or doing something else, so that we really can try to stimulate the market and develop some bands. And I brought a couple posters from a couple that we're doing right now, just to show you. This is one by a band called CSS from Brazil. Very kind of cool. Are you laughing?
I'm laughing just because it's a tech term.
Oh, yeah. That's not why they used it.
Humor.
And this one's a Small Sins and Little Ones poster. And we're really trying to work both with visual artists and some of our ads and stuff that are coming out too. So it really is a focus for us. And while it's limited at the moment, hopefully that's something that we can grow over time.
So there are submission guidelines on our site. It gives you some of the name and the address where you need to send an album to if you want to send us your CD. We also have Pandora-hyphen support, and I can tell you that there are real live people answering every email that comes in. You will get a personal response back if you write to us. And you know, we've done some surveying. About 30% of Pandora listeners report that they buy more music as a result of listening to Pandora. So you should also make sure that your music is on iTunes. And I know that you can do that as an indie artist through CD Baby, as I've done. And we also fulfill Amazon, so Amazon Instant Advantage program is something anybody can go ahead and do. I think there's actually something telling in how we've grown our audience and our community, and it's been through good old-fashioned word of mouth. And the last time I was here in Seattle, I was at the Experience Music Project for something called Meetup, which is the way we have marketed. It's very grassroots. We put on our blog, Tim, our founder, is coming to Seattle. He's going to be at the Experience Music Project on Wednesday evening. RSVP if you want to come meet him and chat about music. And it started with him, you know, showing up at a bar in Austin and maybe one or two people rolling in and say, hey, Tim, may I listen to Pandora? But it grew and grew. So I was actually had the privilege of being at the last meetup here. And we packed that other auditorium. There were people outside waiting to get in. And to me, this was really just remarkable that anybody would love a product so much to want to come out on a rainy Wednesday and talk to the founder. But they're really, especially, I think, in a world where there's so much white noise and so much going on the internet, that there's really no substitute for an old-fashioned one-to-one human interaction.
And as a company, that is how we market. We don't buy advertising. We talk to our customers, and we reach out to them, and we touch them anytime we can. And as a band, I still believe that's the best way for a band.
I'm not a vendor. But I want to sell bodily noises as ringtones. No, I've got to go away from the belt. You guys got to, I'm not going to do it now because it's recorded. I could. Enough of the gas here. I shouldn't have had that breakfast burrito earlier. I realized it was going to blow up. Well, or not blow up, as the case would be. From my perspective, it's interesting to sit up here amongst vendors as someone who just consumes music, and I'm someone who spends over $300 a month on entertainment, whether that be my Comcast subscription or I have an Urge subscription, which is in conjunction with Windows Media Player, and I've got a Napster, and yada, yada, yada. The thing I'm sick and tired of is paying for the same song over and over and over and over again. Another thing I'm frustrated with is DRM, and I think there's a time and place for DRM, but I know as artists you should be concerned about it, but if you should be more concerned that nobody's listening to it, if nobody's stealing it, it's not worth stealing. So get it to the point where it's worth stealing, and then be concerned about how you're going to be able to find it. So. Apparently this audience is with me, so that makes me feel a little better. But we're all music consumers, whether we're producers or whatever role we have in this ecosystem. But I think the bottom line is, as long as, and I think each one of the vendors speaks to this, you're in control. I mean, ultimately, and I realize the bigger the company, the more they don't want to hear that. But that is the case. I mean, whether or not you want someone to rip your album and put it on a P2P network or BitTorrent and share the song with somebody else, there's so much out there now. We're in overload, and we're already getting to the point where I have to watch my fiance to make sure she's not buying a subscription that we already have, and that we paid for a movie 13 times that we haven't even watched once. And unfortunately, we're not at the point where there's so much content, and there's this many vendors, and pretty soon, and I hate to say this, the vendors are going to be marginalized because there's so much content that you're going to be able to speak directly to your audience and do whatever the hell you want to do as an artist or even as a company. I realized, wow, anarchy rules, but I'm really not that way. Sorry, I'm not a vendor.
Well, let me make the case for DRM. I was just going to say, RSS really, I think, is an important bit of technology to bear in mind, because it's this wonderful and magical way of distributing your content that has, I think, a really important role to play in how your music gets discovered. And once you establish your RSS connections around through blogs and sites like Melodio.com or Podshow or Podcast Pickle or whatever, then every future episode or future track or whatever you publish is automatically received and distributed through those outlets. It's a really important new publication syndication technology that is, I think, critically important to, especially to indie music artists. Early on when we launched our music service, we needed in order to get major label content, we needed to have a digital rights benefit solution that they were happy with. So we developed our own. And we launched it in Spain, we launched it in Canada, we signed a joint venture in China. And then we realized that, the odds were stacked hugely against a small 30-person company from Seattle to compete with, say, Real Networks and Microsoft and all these other companies on digital rights management. So we opened it up as open source technology about 5 months ago. And since then, we've had a couple of hundred downloads of our source code for a DRM solution that was good enough for Sony and Warner and EMI and Universal, and is actually quite flexible, and it's basically free. So, there are codecs like God of Orbis, there are free codecs that are pretty high quality stuff. Now there's basically a free digital rights management technology out there that I think is worth exploring, because if your music can be stolen, it will be stolen. There's no question about that. Once, you know, when you're famous, obviously it's going to get stolen. If it's not protected, you're not going to get paid for your content. So this argument about DRM is one that I think is, you can go on forever and ever and ever about it, but if you have valuable technology, valuable content, sorry, you want it to be protected, you want to get paid for it, you have to have some sort of digital rights management in place, but it has to be user-friendly. I think what's come so far is not user-friendly.
Bill, what is that called, the one that you released?
It's called PackageRM, P-A-C-H-Y-D-R-M. You know, all open source stuff like Linux has a penguin, we had to come up with an animal. just a quick little break. Does everybody understand what DRM is out there? Can you raise your hands if you do understand DRM? Okay, pretty much everybody. And does everybody understand what RSS is? Can you hand if you understand? Okay, we got a bunch of no's. RSS stands for really simple syndication. And what it is, it's a method of, initially it was invented a long time ago by Netscape, but it allows you to, for instance, subscribe to somebody's blog, and every time they update their blog, you get notified, hey, Steve's updated his blog, so you go check it out. Now what they've done is they've added an enclosure tag, bear with me, that basically allows you to attach a media file to your RSS feed, and that's how podcasting works. You go to iTunes, you go, oh, I really like Zay Frank. I'm going to subscribe to his RSS feed. Every time Zay Frank puts a new video on his site, iTunes checks it. iTunes tells you, hey, there's a new Zay Frank episode. Do you want me to download it for you? Or, of course, you can just set it to just automatically download it. So it's a way of getting, basically, for people to subscribe to something of yours, whether it's a blog feed or a podcast. And it's incredibly powerful. It's what's driving the whole podcasting revolution right now. We'll get to questions a little bit later, or comments if you know. All right. So one of the things I find interesting is that Microsoft is now doing sort of a hybrid approach where they're actually funding artists, whether it's artwork or even you guys have a band out now where you're sending bands out on tour.
The CSS.
Right. So, you know, as powerful as it is to get your own stuff out there, anybody who lives in Seattle knows there's only a limited amount of clubs we can play here. At some point, you want to play out. You know, and it costs money for gas and all this stuff. So tell me about the ways in which you guys might be assuming sort of a more traditional approach, or if you are, about sort of funding bands and trying to break bands. Is that something that you guys do? I know you do, so let's start with you.
Yeah, so we're definitely doing that. I think that we are trying to partner with artists and with record labels to help support the industry. And as I think I said before, we're definitely kind of in a transitional period from where we have been to where we're going. We think that the future kind of digital marketplace is really rich, and there are going to be a lot of exciting things that are going to happen for communities and for artists and for fans, and hopefully we enable a lot of that to happen. In the meantime, if there's any way that we can partner with artists and with the industry to support them, that's what we want to do. And that does include doing things at physical retail to help sell CDs, as well as get people into the store to buy things, downloads.
We're 1 year old, and so we had an incredible scaling challenge in the last year, actually growing to the listener base that we have and it continues. So this past year has really for us been characterized by holding on for dear life. I think we're very optimistic about the future that we will have a long, healthy life as a company, and I think there are many things that we can do going forward, but to date it's really been about growing an audience and helping try to make those connections for listeners and for artists.
We've been focusing on broad distribution of the client software. There's a little bit of Java code that we put on mobile phones that enables you to search this large catalog of podcasts and music. And so we've done distribution deals with Singular, which now has Mobilecast, as we call it, Mobilecast on their network, and Alltel. We're certified on Sprint's network, et cetera. So we're trying to get the carriers to, obviously they have tens of millions of subscribers. We want them to help us to push out this technology so that subscribers can have access to content like podcasts and music. As I said earlier, the carriers are not naturally cooperative, and they obviously want to make money on this stuff. So they're going to ask people to pay for the bandwidth you use when you download podcast music. That's okay. They built the networks, and that's how they monetize it. By the way, that's the way you get paid too through carriers. Is they have this incredibly efficient billing mechanism that's much more efficient than PayPal or credit card, et cetera, or iTunes. So I think, Thomas, you said you get something like 6 cents per track downloaded on iTunes. A large part of that is because I think the cost of credit card charges on iTunes is about 11%, something like that. So there's a big chunk of that 99 cents that you pay that goes just to Visa for handling the payment. So carriers have, in spite of all the other things that carriers represent as barriers and impediments, they have an incredibly efficient micropayment system that's perfectly designed for digital content. I like to call it digital hors d'oeuvres that people are consuming in little bits. So in addition to pushing the client out, our software platform out to carriers, we're also engaging with media companies to have them distribute it. It's free. It's a free download. You know, we don't charge anything for our software. We don't charge anything for the content. We are looking at various models, advertising included, and I'd be interested in hearing what the artists in the room think about their music being paid for with advertising, just in principle or on principle. We're engaging with carriers in Asia, in Europe, in Latin America, all over the planet to push out this little bit of software that enables people to search, stream, and or download and share on their own their podcasts and music.
I actually do have something. It's a marketing jump in tip, I guess. If you want to get your music discovered, one way of doing it is instead of putting, you can put a copyright on it, sure, but investigate Creative Commons licensing for your art. And that might help because at least people who may want to use it will know exactly how they can use it. Make it pod safe, podcast safe, and make it known that it can be replayed in podcasts that are maybe not profit. There are certainly ways that you can get your own music out there or your label, whatever music you have control over or help with, you can get it out there. And using podcasts as a vehicle is tremendous. I mean, the word of mouth marketing is not underestimated. It's extremely powerful, and it can work to your advantage or to your detriment, depending on how you use that vehicle.
Chris, while you got it, why don't you explain what PodSafe music is?
PodSafe would basically mean that the song or whatever could be replayed in a podcast in conjunction with what they call a Creative Commons license, and I believe creativecommons.org. Probably search for it on any search engine and can find it, allows you to put freedoms and restrictions on how that piece of whatever is used, whether it's a document, whether it's a piece of art, a photo, or music, a movie, a film, whatever, by putting that, and you could say, here, you could reuse this as long as you don't use it commercially, and that you provide attribution, and that any changes that you make can be used from that point forward. So other people would be able to continue to change that work. It may sound confusing, because it's a relatively new concept in terms of a new kind of copyright, if you will. But in conjunction with putting that kind of those freedoms on your song, you can hand it to a podcaster, or just say, any podcaster out there who wants to play this, do, please, play this song. Please, I'm begging you. I mean, you don't have to go that far. But when you put it out there as pod safe, that lets podcasters who are looking to create, you know, music lineup that they don't have to worry about fees and, paying and yada, 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 then they know that your music or this particular track is pod safe. So they can use it, they can reuse it, they can put it from point A to point B, you just want it out there. And that's another extreme, well, free. I mean, the time that you put into it, but it's a free marketing vehicle for you to use. And there are thousands of people out there wanting to use your music.
We're going to talk a little bit about more a little later. I think it's the next panel about don't give all your tracks away. Don't make them all pod safe. You don't want to give everything away, but you definitely want to seed the podcasting world with enough of your music. And that's a really good way to get your stuff out there, because the cool thing about podcasting is that 99.9% of all podcasters are extremely passionate about what they do. They're doing it because they love it. So what you can do is go to any search engine, or any podcasting search engine, find out who are the top 10 podcasts who play music. Listen to their stuff, see if it's stuff that you like and that you think your music's going to fit in. Hit them on email, send them an MP3 and say, I love your show. I thought you might like my track. And these people already have built-in audiences of tens of thousands of listeners who are already downloading their stuff. So that's a great way to get your stuff out there. And of course, when you talk to guys, say, hey, look, if anybody comments on my song, do me a favor, send me their email address or try and get some sort of reciprocal link. Most podcasters are more than happy to say, you know, this is Steve Mack's band. You can check his stuff out at stevemack.com, whatever. They'll do this for you. All you have to do is ask. So a thing I want to touch on is that, as Thomas mentioned, we're in this sort of hybrid area where there are a number of agencies who are starting to understand that they can take up a non-traditional role. They're not really management, but they're aggregating a large number of, say, unsigned artists and helping get your stuff out. I mean, CD Baby is like A to Z, they do everything, but there's a lot of other organizations who will work with you and try and get you noticed. Could you guys speak a little bit about how you guys work with these aggregation agencies or even independent agents who come to you?
Well, we definitely work with a lot of aggregators, IOTA, CD Baby, GarageBand, others who will offer their music for sale or for subscription. So we have deals with all of those guys to do that. And in addition to that, I think are available for conversations and meetings and reach out to them on a regular basis to see what records are coming out and what people are interested in promoting. So that's really the moment, probably the basics of the friendship we have with them.
Do you think it would offer a band a substantial advantage to work through one of these agencies?
I think, we don't have any kind of discrimination. If you come and do a deal with us directly, or you want to work with CD Baby, or you want to sign to Geffen Records or somebody else, you know, the most important thing is getting the music and getting the music made available.
I would say that as a web company, and certainly one that's being referred to as a Web 2.0 company, in some ways we're very old-fashioned. We actually still take physical discs. We rip them and create the highest quality copy so that we have that and then can re-encode it at the right format and bit rate to deliver it to our audience in different ways. Our musicians, when they're listening to the song, are looking at the liner notes. They're recording some of the metadata there, like the way the music is released. They're also looking at some of the instrumentation and stuff that's annotated. So because of that, we actually have relationships with distributors who send us physical discs.
Right.
But we don't yet have a way to ingest the visual music. I think that would certainly change.
Well, we find we're working with a number of the online music aggregators. We have on our mobilecast service now, we have 7 or 8 channels, I guess, that are supported by AccuRadio, which is one of the leading web streaming radio stations. And we hope to expand that, and we're having discussions with the Orchard and CD Baby and IOTA and all the other aggregators. And also, it's possible with this RSS technology for people to subscribe to an individual podcast. We have feeds from about 5,000 podcast creators, all the big media companies and all the, you know, the guys in a garage with a Mac and a microphone at the bottom of the pyramid. And somewhere in between are all these artists out here who can create an RSS feed. And if I subscribe to your RSS feed, every new episode that you create is automatically pushed out to this client on mobile, and I can hear your music every time you have something new. So a combination of making it easy for individuals using this magical stuff called RSS to put their stuff in a catalog so that people can listen to it, plus relationships with the major online music aggregators is, I think, the way to go.
In the interest of trying to make up some time here and keep things moving along, we're going to move to questions and answers. I just want to say that if we don't get to your question, because we're not going to have an entire question and answer period, you can probably tuck your sleeve and get an email address. Also, just to make a pitch for Naris, we're here for the artists. The idea is to connect you guys with these people, so you can always come straight to the Naris board or anybody with Naris, and we'd be more than happy to make the introduction, connect with these people, because we're here to try and get some information to you. So with that said, let's open it up for questions right there.
Yeah, Christine, what you compare Zoom to the iPod, can you tell us gives it its distinctive flavor, what makes it a little different there?
Sure. This particular device that we have coming out right now is very similar to the video iPod. So it's 30 gigs. It's got a bigger screen, so it's a 3-inch screen that flips if you want to watch a movie or a video. So we think that there's an advantage there, and the screen looks really great when it's lit up. It also has an FM tuner built in, so you can listen to radio without having to buy any kind of an accessory. And every device does come with wireless, so I've talked about that a couple times, but you can personalize it, so you can put your own picture of your dog or your vacation or whatever else on the background, so instantly you'll know which one is yours. Comes in 3 different colors, and you name it, so similar to an Xbox gamer tag, you're going to end up having an identity, that, of course, we can grow over time so that if you were training a lot of people on the music, you might get some points back. The points work with the Xbox system, so there's a nice integration across there. And the kind of minimal wireless scenario right now is if I'm listening to a song that I think Steve would like, I can just find him here and beam it across to him, and then he can listen to that. And if he likes it, when he goes back to his PC, if it's available, he'll have a trigger there to buy it. So it's actually, it sounds kind of basic, but if we try it, there's something really fun about actually just sending a song across and then getting to listen to something that your friend sent you. So those are really the main
But things. Isn't it kind of live and more instant than the iPod? Doesn't it give you capabilities?
In the sending?
Yeah.
iPod doesn't have that.
So that's
something that we do have.
Question. So it seems with the advent, you know, or the push towards media fragmentation, consumer control, it's easier to produce music and distribute it. Marketing, of course, is still hard and get noticed. It seems like the consumers are still at the whims of consumer electronic manufacturers, and to put you on, maybe on the seat of heat, there's a lot of limitations, right? So 90%+ of people who don't have an MP3 player or iPod, here's another device which, you know, it doesn't even work with the Windows Media Player. You can only wirelessly transmit through another Zoom. The song disappears after 3 days. You have to install another device. So it seems like consumers are like, I'm not going to even do my time shift and play shift consumption of music until these people get it right. So I have a device that everybody can use and trade, and like the cell phone, it's pretty ubiquitous.
Our vision again, and it's hard to talk about what's happening right now, because there are definitely limitations to what we can do right now. But I think almost everything you said is hopefully where we hope things are going to go moving forward. So one of the things I know Chris talked about this too is like, don't make me keep buying the same song. That's one of our key principles, is we do want to make it so that when you buy a song, you bought the song. And over time, you can play it on your Xbox, you can play it on your PC, you can play it on your cell phone. If you bought it, you own it. And we're going to make sure that you can find it, whether you buy a new PC or something else. So that's really key. At the moment, yeah, there's a lot of limitations. And when we looked at putting out the device, while Windows will continue to have the program that develops the codec and the DRM that all of the different services that are using Windows technologies can use, there's clearly been a success with the iPod and the kind of parameters like, give me the device that works with the service and I don't even have to think twice about it. And so we're doing that. We know we can ensure that there's a very smooth consumer experience in that way, and that's really why that's where it is today.
I think even more so than device limitations, it's much bigger than that. How many of you guys have AOL buddies? How many of you have MSN buddies? How many of you have Google buddies? How many of you have Yahoo buddies?
It's like her.
You got too many buddies.
Way too many buddies. No, there are a lot of people that have buddies across all networks. Well, it's your identity, and it's the fact that I have to have 13 different profiles when it's the same profile over and over and over and over and over again. And the only way it's going to get solved is not, I swear to God, it's not going to come from a big company. It's going to come from the ground up. RSS? Ground up. Podcasting? Ground up. That's the way technology works. And then when it gets up here, it can be monetized effectively in an entire platform strategy and placed into a business plan and then funded for billions of dollars. That's when it, you know, hits. But don't expect any vendor, hardware, software, et cetera, to get it. They won't. They never will. And that, with all respect, I'm sorry.
I want to try and keep this on track. Let's not complain about technologies not working, interacting, because we know a lot of this stuff isn't there yet, and a lot of vendors are working to try and solve these problems. We're not going to solve them today. If you have a specific question about my Zoom or something like that, let's save those parameters. Let's talk a little bit more general about what you want to know about interacting with either these services or just getting your band out there. There's a hand raised right there.
Hi, I'm David Bratton from Project Opus. And Bill, you and Thomas had mentioned that you think the pricing of music is being pressured down towards the margins. Mm-hmm. And that it's going to be offered through basically an ISP as an extra added or something along those lines or through some sort of connectivity. if the pricing of music, and this is sort of a question to the audience here, is trying to make offer vending services. If music is being pushed to the margins as a pricing method, where does DRM fit in that model when a price of a song is at a fraction of a cent? And as such, where is the value for 3 years from now, the artist is selling an audio file? Is that clear?
Yeah.
Right. I'll let the panelists, I have an opinion about this, but I don't want the panelists to start.
Well, obviously, I don't think it's going to be pushed down to zero or a fraction of a penny. I think what's happening is that because you have more control over what happens to it, you have a greater share of what the consumer is willing to pay for. Use the example of the music we're selling over the air in Spain on Tall Pines Network. 1.5 euros, that's about $1.80 per track. 75% of that goes to the music label. 75% of that goes to the carrier. That doesn't matter. Actually, roughly 96-97% of that is split between the carrier and the music label. We get a tiny little fraction of that, and the music label is then responsible for paying something to the artist. In this new world, I think the artist, to the extent the artist is tech savvy and knows how to do this and market themselves, can create the content, can distribute the content, can use podcasts and RSS and PodSafe Music, you have a greater chance of getting a larger share of whatever the market price is. If it's 99 cents, if it stays there, that's great. I think it's going to go down. And it should be based on real demand for the product, not just a fixed price of 99 cents. If people are willing to pay $2 for your track, more power to you. That's great. But you still need to have some form of DRM involved. Otherwise, if people can take digital content, it will be taken. It will be taken for free. So I think you just have to wrestle with that. You have to have some form of digital rights management in order to protect any chance of getting monetized, getting money for your content. I think the mobile phone, because of this billing mechanism that's built in, is really quite well designed for this. All you have to do is take the carriers out of the equation, which is happening. And this so-called walled garden that the carriers now impose on their subscribers is breaking down dramatically, starting in Europe and in Asia, and coming soon to a carrier near you. The carriers are now opening up to more of an ISP-type model, where you have a phone, you have a service plan, you should have access to anything that's available on the internet on your mobile phone with no intervention or extraction by the carrier from the content that you're listening to.
One of the things that's interesting to note is that in the music industry, even the old-fashioned music industry, is how the predominant consumption of music is and always has been radio, not owned music. And it's just some stats to share with you. The average U.S. consumer listens to 16 hours of music radio a week, and they listen to 3 hours of music that they own a week. The average U.S. consumer buys $50 worth of music a year. And traditionally, with terrestrial radio, only the songwriters get paid, because ASCAP and BMI collect for terrestrial radio play, but the labels didn't get paid anything, and they saw it as the promotional vehicle to help them to sell more music. In the webcasting world, the labels also get paid through Sound Exchange. We write a big check to Sound Exchange every month. And so as technology continues to evolve and the connection, we now have broadband connection on mass to PCs. Broadband connection, so 3G to your cell phones, is growing very, very fast. And right behind it on its heels is WiMAX. And when WiMAX comes in, you will have a broadband connection to your vehicle as well. So I expect that the future of the music industry will be a lot like the past, in as much as radio consumption will be the primary way that the mass market consumes music. The good news is that that artists will get a share from Sound Exchange in the future where they didn't in the past.
Personally, DRM it's a really sticky topic in the tech world right now, because obviously everybody wants to protect their copyright. But I think a large part of the problem is that I don't think it's music that's being commoditized, it's the distribution of music that's being commoditized. You don't have to press these little discs up and send them to a truck. The cost of distributing digitally is peanuts. The problem now is access. Getting access to this music and getting through these walled gardens is the thing that's difficult and the thing that costs money. I think once we can move to a situation where basically all music is a subscription, I pay $25 a month, I get all the music I want, I don't need to own music because I can find any track anywhere, anytime, whether it's through Rhapsody, Pandora, or whatnot. And the thing is, with these new digital services, it's trivial to figure out exactly how many times things got paid. And so the artist will get paid in this new scenario. It just doesn't have to. The problem now is, you know, as Phyllis said, it's with the carriers who are still trying to take too large a piece of the pot. Another question.
You mentioned about MySpace and the more people that you have signed up. And somebody just put up a site for me. People have been wanting to be friends, but I look at their friends and they're scary. And I don't know whether to just be very picky, which is what I've done so far, or just welcome everybody. So what do you do?
Chris. Why when someone says scary person? MySpace is interesting. Social network, that whole paradigm is interesting. Just because I mark someone as a friend does not necessarily mean they are my friend. MySpace did an absolutely horrible job at managing this, as do most what they call social networks on the web. MySpace, though, there's going to be scary people around every corner, and you wouldn't necessarily, I don't think, be hurting yourself by accepting them as friends. The number, you know, could show 1,000 all the way up to 1,500. Chances are the only thing that most people are going to look at are the top 8 spaces, and the top 8 people. I've never, as many times as I've drilled down, I've never drilled down that far into someone's friend network, because maybe I'm just not a MySpace user. But just because you say that they're your friend, I don't think that people really think that they're your friend. And I mean that in the general sense. So I'm saying, I wouldn't worry about it in terms of the social stigma of people are going to associate you with these scary people. There's actually, physiologically speaking, Emotional Intelligence is a book, and the author's name eludes me, but he speaks directly to when people get online, part of their frontal lobe actually shuts down. I kid you not. I censored myself there, which is just radical. The empathy center, where as I'm talking to you and I'm interacting with you, if I disagree vehemently, as I may do at times, not necessarily with you, with anybody, in a social situation, the construct is different. I have all these elements and I have to worry because I have an empathy nerve in my brain. I'm not a doctor, I'm just a geek. But essentially, when you get online and you're sitting in front of this monitor, you have no social cues. You're sitting in front of a piece of hardware. You have no connections with anything other than just this screen. So that's where you see a lot of people be a little more free with themselves online than they would be in person. But it's actually a physiological reason why. I mean, there's a part of the brain that shuts down when you don't have those social cues. Emotional intelligence is the book.
And I'll just add to that, my own personal experience with MySpace is partner promiscuously. I accept every friend invitation I get for my music, because even if I don't have a chat with them, there are going to be people from their side who will see my and hear my music. And so I just accepted every invitation that's come my way. But ironically, a few days after I put up my MySpace page, I got an email that a friend request from somebody who was the booker of the coffee shop, which is literally around the block from my house. Mm-hmm. So at the same time that, you know, I'm friends with lots of people who I've never had a conversation with, but they've heard my music, and maybe some of their friends have heard my music too, MySpace did make a connection for me, which was really, really relevant. And I conduct myself very differently on MySpace than I do, for example, on LinkedIn, which is a professional network. When people say, you know, will you link to me, would you recommend me, and I will decline lots of invitations if I don't really know the person or I wouldn't feel comfortable recommending them. So I think different communities, you have different behaviors for. But for spreading your music on MySpace, you know, make those tentacles as far and wide as you want.
One other little piece of that is that I ignored all these people for about 2 months, and then when I finally decided to make the plunge, and I went back, and about half of them had been deleted, and it was either because they withdrew or because they were spammed or something like that.
Spammed.
We have to wrap this up. Thank you guys for being so patient.